Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. But we've got a real treat for you today because we're going on a field trip. And not just any field trip, we're going to a field trip, we're going on a field trip to the birthplace of the United States Constitution. Not the birthplace of the whole country. No, I'm not talking about Boston. Sorry, all you people up in Massachusetts. I'm not talking about tea parties. I'm talking about the place where our elected representatives got together in a room and did two extraordinarily important things. Now, the first of them you probably figured out. It's 1776, and the Second Continental Congress gets together, and they write themselves a Declaration of Independence. Very brave act, and that starts, at least officially, starts our independence from Britain. Did you know that 11 years later, though, that almost the same group of people, well, that overstates it, many of the same people and some others came back together in the same room, and that's where they adopted our Constitution, or at least the first seven articles of our Constitution. And they did this all in one building that we now call Independence Hall. It used to be known as the Pennsylvania State House. We now call it Independence Hall. And therein lies the problem. Most people know that Independence Hall is where we declared independence. And even in popular culture, you know, movies have been made about the Declaration of Independence and even been filmed at Independence Hall. Relatively few people know that's where the Constitution was drafted as well. But we're going to dispel all of that ignorance today, aren't we? Because we're going to Independence Hall. Oh, I went to Independence Hall, and you get to come along, and I got a special tour with a very special fellow. His name is Adam Duncan. He is a ranger with the National Park Service, which runs Independence Hall, along with lots of other historic sites in the United States. And Adam and I spent a remarkable day, most of an entire day, going through Independence Hall and through several other interesting buildings as well. Now, we don't have time for all of that tour today, but the part of the day I spent in Independence Hall, well, I'll let Adam tell you all about it.
Sure. My name's Adam Duncan. I'm a National Park Service ranger at Independence National Historical Park.
Tremendous. And we're standing out here on a bright, beautiful day in May in 2011. And Adam has very kindly agreed to talk to me and take me around Independence Hall. So take it away, Adam.
Sure. One of the things that I find most people pondering is when they come here is this a national park? It's very unique national park because we are in an urban environment where when most people think of a national park, they think of Yellowstone or Yosemite or the Grand Canyon.
I'll give you a little bit of background to these buildings. If you can, as hard as it's going to be, if you can kind of put yourself in an 18th century mindset, and we get a little bit with the horse and carriages coming by, but imagine no cars, no planes, no skyscrapers. Where we're standing right now is actually the center of Philadelphia at the time in the 18th century. Independence Hall, certainly it was not called that 200 years ago when it was when construction started. It's the center of a very large city in 18th century Great Britain and the northern colonies here in North America. The building started very simply, very modestly, as the capital for the colony. It would be where the governor would hold his office, where the assembly would meet, where the judiciary, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, would meet. It started in 1732 with construction and would take about 24 years to complete, ultimately all the way up into the top of the tower in 1756. But they used the building for meetings as early as 1736.
So they kind of went in stages?
Went in stages.
Okay, and I see there are two wings on it. Were those wings completed after the main structure?
Right around the same time, but the main structure first and then kind of concurrent construction on the two wing buildings. Today, unfortunately, the wing buildings are not the original wing buildings. Why do old buildings last so long? Because they find other uses. And that's what the city of Philadelphia did. After Philadelphia is no longer the state capital, it leaves here in Pennsylvania in 1799. The city takes over the buildings that were constructed next to Independence Hall as well. We see City Hall on the far left, and then what we now call Congress Hall on our far right, but that was actually the county courthouse for Philadelphia. And we call it Congress Hall because from 1790 till 1800, that's where the United States Congress met.
Wow, that was during, when was that again?
1790 until May of 1800.
Okay, and that was after they struck the deal moving the Capitol down from New York City in anticipation of the construction of Washington, D.C.
Yes, sir, and so it's those 10 years that that construction down in D.C., where what they called the federal city.
Right.
It was those 10 years while that construction's going on. The Congress is meeting here. The President's House was just one block where the Liberty Bell Center is. Today, we just opened the commemoration of the President's House.
So is that still standing?
No, the President's House was torn down in 1832.
What a shame.
Absolutely. Okay. It was a rental property. And actually,
the president lived in a rental house.
Yes, sir. Philadelphia did build an executive mansion for the president, right. But both Washington and Adams refused to live in it because you know, they're trying to court Philadelphia to remain the capital of the United States. But they borrowed a home from Congressman Robert Morris, also known as the financier of the American Revolution, signer of the Constitution as well.
Okay.
But we call this building Independence Hall today because of what happened there in July of 1776. By no means was that the original purpose of the bell, of the building, as I had mentioned. It just kind of happens to be where Congress is meeting in 1776 when the resolution for independence is made on the floor of Congress. So it's because of that event that we call it, by its nickname, really, Independence Hall.
And that's very important that you mention that because, of course, a lot of people know that this is where the Declaration of Independence was written.
Yes, sir.
And a lot of people have seen the movie 1776, which I'm sure we'll talk about. It was filmed here, or at least part of it was. But I think fewer people realize that just a few years later that many of the same people and some new people met here to actually draft our Constitution.
Yeah, just an 11-year, very short time period, if you think about it. The former system, the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, it was kind of brought to a head, mostly because of Shays' Rebellion, but some other events that would take place. So when they meet here, their charge is really to improve the Articles of Confederation. And under the Articles, it required unanimous consent to change. All the states had to agree. I can't get four friends to decide where to go to dinner.
Me neither.
You know, you can imagine. And that's why in the Constitution today, they don't have the unanimous clause in there to amend the Constitution. Because you're never going to get everybody. Back then, you only needed 9 of the 13 when the Constitution is first enacted.
Right.
But under the Articles, it required everybody. Well, Rhode Island doesn't show up in 1787. In fact, New York would walk out, and only Alexander Hamilton would return. And he did sign the Constitution, but technically, it required 2 to sign for your state.
Alexander Hamilton sort of did what he thought best, didn't he?
Yes, sir. A very unique character. Although most of our founders and the framers of the Constitution were very unique individuals and gentlemen. But Hamilton does come back, and he ultimately would sign the Constitution, but he's the only signer of New York.
Okay.
Why don't we, at this time, let's walk over, and we'll go inside Independence Hall.
Okay. So we're actually in the main entrance hall to Independence Hall now, and Ranger Adam Duncan is going to start talking and tell us about the interior now.
Well, when you first walk into the building, you come into a large hallway. It's about 40 feet in ceiling, and all the rooms in this first floor are 40 feet high, basically 40 by 40. To our right is the Supreme Court chamber for the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and then also to our left is the Assembly Room. That's the room everybody comes to see. That's where the Second Continental Congress met, but also the Grand Federal Convention. To be technical, to the 18th century, that's what they called it, until afterwards it becomes the Constitutional Convention. The colors are as original as we imagine, and through many, many years of investigations, many paint studies, we know that this was the color of the building. In the main hallway, this kind of grayish, beige color, pumpkin in the courtroom, and then blue and white in kind of a slate blue and white in the assembly room. It took about 20 layers of paint to really determine that.
Wow. We know these. You stripped away 20 layers of paint.
Yeah, and
wow.
In there are certain areas of the building, they left those layers intact, so future generations
if they want to investigate it, maybe they prove us wrong and say, no, it was actually this color in the 1770s.
Wouldn't that be funny if the whole thing should be purple?
Well, it certainly was a rainbow going through the paint layers.
Well, I notice as we look to our right into the Supreme Court chamber that it's open, that there is no doorway between the main hall and the Supreme Court chamber. Was that the way it was back in the 18th century?
You know, certainly they wanted to kind of what we enjoy in our court system today. It's open to the public. There's no doors to close or anything. So citizens of the 18th century, you know, without law and order, all these TV shows to keep them entertained. And you can imagine it's a pretty small city in today's standards. Back then it was very large, about 40,000 people. Everybody knew everybody. So it would be a source of entertainment, see which one of your neighbors is in trouble. So people would come quite regularly to attend the court sessions.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And a very interesting point, too, that was made by Professor Beeman, who wrote the Plain Honest Men. We spoke to Professor Beeman several weeks ago on the show, and he points out in his book that since the Supreme Court chamber was right across the hallway, and since there was no divider here, and since, as people can hear, there's quite an echo, that there was a lot of noise out in the hallway.
And Very much so.
So the guys in the Constitutional Convention really had to keep that door closed, not just to keep the secrecy, but to prevent all the noise from getting in.
Yeah, and in 1787, you can imagine Philadelphia summer. It's very humid, very hot. You're wearing long breeches, wool mostly, their clothing's made out of. So it was a big challenge just physically being present. The windows were open. I've read a lot that says they were closed. They were actually open, and there were guards posted outside.
So people couldn't listen in.
They couldn't listen in.
I see.
We know it was very noisy outside with the horse and carriages because they asked that the ground be thrown stones and mud on it so it would kind of dampen the noise.
So they wouldn't clip cloth as loudly. That's very interesting. And I noticed just by coincidence that we're here in the month of May, roughly about the time of year that the Constitutional Convention started.
Yes, sir. And I believe it was the 14th. They first convene and they realize they don't have a quorum. There's hardly anybody here by that point, so they adjourn, and I believe it's the 25th that they pick back up.
Right, and we're right in the middle of that. Well, this is May 18th, isn't it?
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. So they would have been here.
Yeah, very similar weather, and it is already warm, and we're both perspiring, so okay, I appreciate
you
that.
You imagine July.
What July I don't like. Want to imagine July. Okay.
Let's go into the Supreme Court room.
Okay, we're back up in the Supreme Court room.
Now, today we see the Pennsylvania coat of arms. That actually dates to 1785. So it's not original in the building, but it is certainly original to the time frame of the Constitutional Convention. Originally, it would have been the King's coat of arms there under the British crown. But on July 8th, just after the very first public reading of the Declaration of Independence, 9 militia members come in here. It was about 200-pound carving, gilded in gold. They pull it down. They parade it all day long. And they barbecue it. They throw it in the fire down where City Hall is today.
You know, Adam, that really points out something, is that we tend to think of our revolution as being a relatively sedate affair, at least, the decision to go to the revolution. But, of course, there were lots of times where the mob pretty much threatened to take over the process, and that sounds like one of them.
There was a lot of riots going on, especially after the Stamp Act in 1765, and a lot of concerns. I mean, really, in terms of revolutions in the history of the world, ours happened pretty quickly from 1765 until the first shots are fired at Lexington and Concord in 1775. That's not a great deal of time in terms of the other revolutions that have happened. And perhaps the American founders are the most successful revolutionaries in the history of the world. Not only did they defeat their enemy through a very long and costly war, but they also established an experiment over in the hall in 1787, a system that could change. It could flex, not easy, certainly, and they didn't want it to change easy, but they wanted to be able to change as people changed. And I think we'll see that a little bit more when we go in and talk a little bit more about the Constitution.
You know, the more we talk about this, the more it really occurs to me that Independence Hall was the birth chamber of the United States. I mean, this is like the maternity ward for our country. It all happened here, didn't it?
Maternity ward / laboratory.
Yeah,
in terms of political science, absolutely. They were putting together a system that most people have never seen or even heard of, the common person. But, the folks who studied governments back then, they looked at small republics as the only way to have a republic. You couldn't have a large, diverse geographic area and have a successful republic. And I think that was the biggest challenge. But mostly, everybody wanted that. In fact, at the end of the Constitutional Convention, the story goes that Benjamin Franklin was coming out the front doors that we just came in, and a lady stopped him on the street and said, "Dr. Franklin, what kind of government do we have?" He says, "Madam, you have a republic. If you can keep it."
That's quite a challenge to us, isn't it?
Very much so. And I think there have been many time periods, especially during the Civil War, where it was a huge challenge. Can we keep it? Can we preserve what the founders did across the, or what the founders and the framers of the Constitution did across the hallway?
You know, it's funny you should mention the Civil War. I was just reading an article where it was talking about how historians have always wondered why there was such strong pro-Union sentiment. Why didn't the North just let the South go? But there were so many leaders and so many common citizens in our country who really believed in this experiment and who felt very strongly that they wanted it to succeed. And that seems to be the motivating factor for many people at that greatest moment of our constitutional challenge.
They did. And being a Lincoln historian, I couldn't tell you about every battle during the Civil War, but I've studied Lincoln for a great deal of my life. I have very many connections with him. Lincoln, first of all, was here in 1861.
He came to Independence Hall.
February 22nd, 1861.
What was he doing here?
He was invited on his tour, on his route to be inaugurated, to raise the flag over Independence Hall. And he stops here, and he goes into the Declaration Chamber, as he had called it, and he starts pondering what it was that brought the country together, what it was that our founders actually did. And he uses the word Confederacy. What was it that brought this Confederacy together? And if we can just walk into the hallway a little bit. During the course of his speech, he kind of ponders, and he says, "Now, my friends, if this country can be saved based upon the ideals in the Declaration of Independence, no one will be happier than I. If I cannot help to save it, it will be truly awful. I was about to say I'd rather be assassinated on this very spot than to ever surrender it."
He said that in 1861?
That's what he said in 1861. Now, Philadelphians remembered that speech, and 4 years later, after he was assassinated, they laid him on that very spot. At the head of his casket was the Liberty Bell. And if you don't know the words offhand, don't worry, most people don't, it actually says, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." Lincoln believed in that, and certainly most historians believe, and myself and all my research, that it was the issue of slavery that awakened the sleeping giant in Lincoln. He had been out of politics for many years, and then the Dred Scott decision really helped to further him getting back involved in American politics.
Wow. And he came here to Independence Hall and made that important speech, and he was laid here in state, and none of this did I know.
Yeah, it's a story about the building that most people really don't talk about. We try to mention it because it's so significant, especially with the 150th anniversary of the Civil War this year. But we do a 30-minute tour through the building that's open to the public, and you can imagine we have Declaration history, Revolutionary history, Constitutional history. A half hour is by no means enough time.
No, really, certainly not. Have any other presidents come to Independence Hall?
Most of them have come at some point or another. Yeah, I think Zachary Tyler may have been the only one, but I'd have to pull out my list.
Who didn't come?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Sure. Yeah, maybe one or two.
Right.
That weren't here, but most of them were here. I'm just trying to think off the top of my head any others. That's about it, just off my memory.
And I see one of the tours is coming out of the Independence Chamber.
Yeah, we're going to step in just a minute into the A room, as we always call it by short, the assembly room. And I want you to take notice of the chair on the president's platform.
Mm-hmm.
That is the only original piece of furniture, dates to 1779, but it was here in 1787, and it happens to be the chair that George Washington sat in while presiding over the Constitution.
Oh, was that the one with the sunrise?
The rising sun.
Oh, boy, I'm looking forward to that story. And we'll hear that story right after the break, when your weekly Constitutional continues its tour of Independence Hall.
All right, gentlemen, let's get on with it. Which of us will write our Declaration of Independence?
Mr. Adams, I say you should write it. To your legal mind and brilliance we defer.
Is that so? Well, if I'm the one to do it, They'll run their quill pens through it. I'm obnoxious and disliked, you know that, sir.
Yes, I know.
But I say you should write it, Franklin. Yes, you.
Hell no.
Yes, you, Dr. Franklin. You.
My name is Stuart Harris, and you're listening to your weekly Constitutional. We're on a field trip. We're on a tour of America's birthplace, Independence Hall, and we're just about to hear a very exciting story.
Now we come to the climax of any visit to Independence Hall, and this, of course, is the assembly room. And once again, I'm going to turn it over to Ranger Adam Duncan.
Now, right now, the room is kind of set up in two different time periods. There's 13 tables. Certainly, there were not 13 states here in 1787, because Rhode Island does not show up. So it's mostly the Declaration setup, but also it's the Constitution. We have the chair in the aisle representing Benjamin Franklin sitting in the aisle. He was very ill at the time. He found it a challenge to walk great distances, so he was carried to the building. And it's from that area that he notices the rising sun on the back of the president's chair.
And it's clearly visible. You really can. You can see that every time that Washington at least got up out of his chair, you could see that.
Sure, and he would have been, you know, he was not sitting in the chair the whole time when they went to the Committee of the Whole.
Right.
I believe it was Rufus King that presided over the Committee of the Whole. So we have it kind of a semicircle. They're arranged north to south. We know that's how they sat.
You mean the northern delegate sat in the northern side of the room, and that's to our left as we're looking up at the chair. And then the southern delegate sat to the right toward the south.
And it's possible we could have it reversed. There's not great details about it. So you have Delaware's table up there. On that table's the quill that we believe was used to sign the Declaration by Caesar Rodney.
Wow.
Pennsylvania's table's right in front of us. Virginia's right next to that. That is actually Thomas Jefferson's walking stick.
That is Thomas Jefferson's walking stick.
Yes, sir.
Wow.
So I mentioned only the chair is original to the building. The rest of the furniture is 18th century. It's antique, certainly old enough to have been here, probably not in this room at the time. But we try to furnish it with books of the time period. If we can get an artifact from one of the framers or the founders, we certainly do. And you'll see some of the books are actually John Hancock's books, his law books.
Wow. Very exciting. It's just a remarkable... It almost raises the hair on the back of your neck to think about all of those people. We're going to hear about that famous chair with the crown, or excuse me, the setting sun or the rising sun on the back of it.
So it's at the end of the Constitutional Convention that Franklin, actually Madison, captures it in his notes. He's overheard talking to some of the other delegates. He's overheard saying that he had long stared at the back of the chair, of the president's chair, and he'd wondered if the artist intended for it to be a rising or a setting sun, because it's a sun on the horizon. And he says, at the very end, he says, "Now at length I have the happiness to know that it is a rising and not a setting sun." Talking about the sun rising on a new nation.
Of course.
And, of course, the old saying was, the sun will never set on the British Isles. So maybe he was kind of...
maybe he's picking up on that. But you know, for a long time, it seemed the sun was setting on the brand new United States of America. Things were not going well under the Articles of Confederation.
Not at all.
So that was really a profound and poetic statement on his part. Well, what else can you tell me about the Constitutional Convention while we have a few minutes here?
Well, certainly one of the biggest... framers, one of my favorite framers is Gouverneur Morris.
Oh, yes. The peg leg fellow.
Peg leg fellow. If you see a painting of him, he's the one with the peg leg. He was quite a character. There's a lot of stories about Gouverneur.
Where did he sit? With New York, I imagine, right?
He was actually Pennsylvania at the time.
Excuse me, that's right. Yeah. He started life in New York, and then he was
a
delegate from
Pennsylvania. Of the Second Continental Congress from New York.
That's right.
And he moved to Pennsylvania.
That's right. Okay.
You know, there's an old story that...
He sat there right next to Franklin, right? Right here in front of us. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And there's a story that Hamilton bets Gouverneur to go up and kind of... And I've heard it three different ways. Kind of grab Washington on the back and say, "Hey, George, how you doing?"
Oh, and you just didn't do that to George Washington because he was very reserved, right?
No, you did not.
So Hamilton and Morris were just kind of... joking around then.
Yeah, and Morris is said to have replied that he did it, but he said he'd rather have the earth open up and swallow him than ever do it again.
Now, I don't believe that. Why is that?
I think historians have captured that story and remember that story mostly because they're trying to convey, one, how serious the time period was, but also how serious of a man George Washington was.
Oh, yes.
He commanded respect just by his fear, just by his mere physical presence when he walked in a room. He never had to say a word.
Right.
Just his stature. You know, he was 6'4", 6'3½".
Right.
Some people speculate.
Big even today, but huge by the standards of the time.
Yeah, and so he commanded respect just by walking in a room.
Now, didn't John Adams, who was famously short and rather rotund, didn't he once complain that George Washington was always the leader of any group because he was the tallest man in the room?
Yeah, he did did mention that.
Oh, poor fella.
But, you know, Washington was an amazing man, and I think he's the glue that held everything together in the early years, the federal period.
I love that story. I love Benjamin Franklin, and I love the spin he put on that rising sun on the back of Washington's chair. Now we get a real treat. We're going to go to parts of Independence Hall that the general public doesn't typically see. In fact, if you go to Independence Hall, try to avoid the summertime and try to avoid the crowds, because if you go then, it's especially if you go around the 4th of July, it's likely you're going to go in, you're going to get the quick and dirty tour, you're going to see the assembly room, and then you'll be back on the street. You certainly won't get to see the second floor. But if you go there during the off-season, the fall or the spring, or maybe even the wintertime if you can, then you might get up on the second floor and you'll see a much more complete representation of what the Philadelphia State House, what we call Independence Hall, has to offer and all the great things that happened there.
Our busier months, it's more of a challenge, and we like to accommodate as many visitors as possible. So when we just stay on the first floor, it's only a 30-minute tour. Whereas if we go up to the second floor, it takes about 15 to 20 extra minutes. So that means less people get to go through every 15 to 20 minutes.
Right.
So the busy season, we want everybody to see the assembly room where the Declaration and the Constitution were written. So that's why the tours don't come up here. And there's not a whole lot of direct history in the events of the Revolution or the Constitution. Probably the most poignant event that would take place on the second floor would be the ratifying committee for Pennsylvania. They did ratify the Constitution, becoming the second state. My home state beat them out by just a few days, which is Delaware.
Now, that's very important. Let's point out that when the Constitutional Convention adjourned in September of 1787, they sent out copies of the Constitution to the 13 states, and then each of those states, or at least nine of them, had to ratify it. And so Pennsylvania, you say, held its ratifying convention right in this room?
Right here in this room.
Okay, tell me about this.
Let's walk a little bit closer, because there's a side room.
Okay.
We call it the committee room, which is where the Pennsylvania Assembly would have broken down into committee and met, which is actually the whole committee met here while the Continental Congress is downstairs and while the Constitutional Convention was going on. So the ratifying committee actually would have ratified it here December 12, 1787, right here in this room. So right now we have it set up to about 1775. We know the city of Philadelphia was storing weaponry, their rifles and their muskets here in the building, which is really how we have it portrayed right now.
Looks like you got about 20 or 30 muskets right up on in the rack there, right?
We do.
Now.
Mm-hmm. We do. Probably a little bit more than that. They are reproduction. They are not originals. We do have original weapons. They're on display in our military museum, which is another two blocks down next to Carpenter's Hall.
Right.
But this is where Pennsylvania got it done, so to speak.
And that was very important. What was the date again of Pennsylvania's ratification?
December 12th.
December 12th of 1787. So that was one of the earlier ratifications, wasn't it?
It was. Whereas, you know, you have your last holdout is Rhode Island.
Rogue Island, yes.
Yeah, and they had been taken over by folks along the lines of Daniel Shays. You know, they were a little bit disgruntled, especially during Shays' rebellion, because they were all fighters. They were all veterans of the Revolution. Their farms have been abandoned, so to speak. The banks were foreclosing. So men like Daniel Shays and led by Daniel Shays kind of became very influential, even though it was many years afterwards, and then Rhode Island ratifying it in 1790. But they kind of had that attitude, so to speak. In 1987, the mayor of Philadelphia invited all the states to return for the bicentennial of the Constitution. And Rhode Island said, we were not there 200 years ago.
Right?
It would not be proper for us to return for the bicentennial. So on the anniversary of the ratification of Rhode Island, Philadelphia invited the Rhode Island governor to come down.
So they still had to do it their own way and on their own schedule 200 years later.
So to speak, yeah. Yeah.
That's hilarious. Now, speaking about ratification by Pennsylvania, now, do we know what role Benjamin Franklin played in that process?
Well, certainly he would have led a very poignant role, a very significant role, because he was a member of the Constitutional Convention, the eldest member, I should say. I really like to call him the founding grandfather. His son was born right around the same time, I believe 1731, 1 year before George Washington.
Right.
He was born in 1732. So Franklin was looked at by this point. I should also mention he's the most famous man in the world, and today
right.
his name is one of the most recognized names around the world, no matter what country you go to. But Franklin was looked upon as an elder, especially here in Pennsylvania. What he had to say pulled a lot of weight, and in fact, during the convention, he makes a speech. He's too ill to actually say it, so he asks someone else, one of his fellow delegates, to say it for him. He writes out this speech, and I'm not going to quote him exactly. I never like to do that. It's very challenging without
cards. Sure it is. I understand.
But essentially, he's looking at some of the dissenters at the convention, because there were three non-signers who were there September 17, 1787, who refused to sign it.
And those were Mason?
George Mason is one of them. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts,
right.
or Gary, some people tell me.
Nobody knows.
It's pronounced differently. And then Edmund Randolph, who becomes our first Attorney General under
right,
the Constitution.
Right, from Virginia, yeah.
So those three men decide that it's just something they can't agree to. So Franklin kind of starts talking through his appointed speaker. And in the speech, Franklin writes and says, you know, there have been many instances in my life where I thought I was right. And then later on, I'm given more evidence that proves me wrong. So I don't know right now if this is absolutely the best constitution or the best government that we come up with, but it's certainly the best one that we can come up with right now.
Right.
To say it in modern speech. So Franklin is appealing to them, saying, guys, come on, sign. At least sign as a witness of what we did here in 4.5 months. They held out. They refused to sign it. So ultimately, we get the 39 names on the Constitution. And I should mention, there's 39 names, 38 signers.
Right.
A little bit of history trivia for you. One person had somebody else forge his name. That would have been...
Hold it. Wait. I'm going to let everybody think for a moment. Who was the forgery? Just think. Okay, now tell us, Adam.
Okay, George Read of Delaware.
Of course, George Read.
A fool of Delaware history. George Read of Delaware forged John Dickinson's name onto the Constitution.
Oh, now he's a prominent fellow. Yeah. He'd been at the Second Continental Congress.
He was.
Well.
He was also a member of the militia, if I believe.
Why did George Read forge John Dickinson's name?
Well, John Dickinson was here most of the summer, but he was called back to business in Wilmington, and he was a little ill. And he says to his colleague George, he says, "Mr. Read, if you happen to sign that instrument while I'm not there, would you please put my name on it?"
Well, that's very nice. Not really a forgery.
Not really
a
forgery.
It was sort of like a secretary signing for her boss.
Very much so.
Okay. All right. Well, that's very interesting. And, of course, there were, I think, over the course of the summer, 55 people who were here. So only 38 of them, or 39 of them, ultimately affixed their names.
74 were appointed to come to the convention. 55 show up. 13, I believe, come and go. Some, most of New York, does not come back. So ultimately, we're looking at 39 out of the original 55 who actually showed up here in the summer of 1787 that signed it.
Very, very interesting.
And remember, there's three others, those three gentlemen that we mentioned earlier, that are in the room, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they just felt they couldn't.
Well, you mentioned Benjamin Franklin and his famous closing speech. I think we could use a little bit of that spirit of compromise today in our politics. I've always thought of Franklin as being among the wisest of the founders, and And I might paraphrase what he said simply as, you know, the older I get, the less sure I am of all my opinions. And I think most wise people would agree with that. As they get older, they realize maybe there's somebody else out there who's got a good opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I'm getting older, I'm only 31, but as I'm getting older, I look at being 20. I was very, very dumb young man at the time. You know, so I imagine
I'm glad I never was. Yeah,
I imagine how I'll feel when I'm 40 and 50. You know, life is cyclical like that. When you get older, there's always somebody out there that calls you a youngster. My grandmother's 86. She got called a youngster by a 96-year-old. So, I imagine with Franklin and the framers, they felt the same way. Mm-hmm. But most of those men, that when they returned to their states, they pushed for ratification. Mm-hmm. Now, certainly, the Bill of Rights or the first 10 amendments were not part of the original Constitution.
Right.
And they're added while the United States Congress is here in Philadelphia. They were meeting in that other building we call Congress Hall today when the Bill of Rights are added in December of 1791. But we'd also get an 11th amendment to the Constitution while both the judiciary, I should say all three, while the judiciary is meeting in City Hall and Congress is meeting over there and the president just a block up. And the 11th Amendment stems from a case that was argued here in Philadelphia. Basically, it was a case dealing with interstate lawsuit, Chisholm versus Georgia.
Oh, yes.
It's called. I'm sure most of the listeners are very familiar with that case. And it says that a citizen of one state cannot sue a citizen of another state in the federal system.
Can't sue the state government, right?
Right.
Right, exactly, for money damages and or... Well, actually, it said, if I recall correctly, now I teach this case, so I should know this, they actually allowed Chisholm to sue the state of Georgia, and that prompted the amendment that
right.
then prohibited, yes.
Right. In fact, Georgia responds to the Supreme Court's ruling, says, if any U.S. marshals come here to enforce it, we will hang them.
The best part of that, I have to add, on Chisholm versus Georgia is that the legislature of Georgia said that if you try to enforce any judgment against us, we will execute you without benefit of clergy. And what that means is you couldn't give your last confession to a priest or to a minister. So essentially, Georgia was sentencing people to hell.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very strong words.
They were so upset by it. And then, of course, within just a few months, the 11th Amendment was passed by the Congress right over there in Congress Hall, mm-hmm. and then was ratified in what was then maybe still record time.
Yeah.
And now, of course, we know that citizens of a state, one state, or essentially anybody, cannot sue a state for money damages without that state's consent under the 11th Amendment.
Exactly.
So all that happened right here as well.
Yeah, just next door to us in
wow.
both of these two buildings.
That is so exciting. Okay. Anything else about ratification or about this particular chamber?
No, I think we covered most of the history of this chamber.
Okay, thank you.
And if you want, we can take a quick look at the governor's room, too.
Love to.
Governor's office.
But you'll have to wait until after the break to hear about the governor's room. In the meantime, isn't this exciting? I get chills every time I go to Independence Hall.
Mr. Secretary, is the declaration ready to be signed?
It is.
Very well. Call the roll.
New Hampshire, Dr. Josiah Bartlett. Massachusetts, Mr. John Adams. Rhode Island, Mr. Stephen Hopkins. Connecticut.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, and now our tour of Independence Hall with Ranger Adam Duncan continues.
We're going into the governor's office, and I'm calling it the governor because at that time, truly the only governor would have been one of William Penn's descendants or Penn himself, but he was dead before this building was even thought of, really. He died in 1718. Any appointee...
If you don't mind, Adam, could we just talk a little bit about the Penn family? Now, if I understand correctly my colonial history, this was a proprietary colony. I mean, the Penn family actually owned the land, right?
They did. And essentially, they're appointed their proprietors by the king to really recover some of the money that William Penn's father, Sir William Penn, or Sir Admiral William Penn, had loaned to the king. Of course, his father was dead by that point, and to repay the debt,
He gives him land in Pennsylvania. And Penn called it the Holy Experiment because he had been arrested many times. I believe I counted up to 18 for his religious beliefs.
William Penn. Okay. Back in England.
Okay. He did not support it. It was a matter of contention between him and his father because he did not subscribe to the Church of England's beliefs.
Right. Was he a Quaker?
He was a Quaker, or they call themselves the Society of Friends.
Right.
So Penn really has this idea of religious freedom and religious tolerance for his colony. Now, certainly, the king's decree would rule as well, but where the king did not rule, or Parliament did not rule, William Penn had the ultimate authority to decide what was going on. So he does grant to his people a representational style of government, but also religious tolerance and religious freedom. Pennsylvania was very unique in the sense of the colonies because of that. If you were Jewish, you can openly practice. If you were Catholic, you can openly practice.
That was a big deal.
It was huge.
That was a big deal because about the same time, or roughly the same time, when John Jay participated in drafting the State Constitution of New York, he announced publicly that one of his purposes was to keep Catholics out of the state. And so anti-Catholic bias was very strong at that time.
Sure, and even later, Philadelphia had anti-Catholic riots in the 1840s.
Yes.
So it really extends. We look at things from a late 20th century, 21st century mindset, but it's only a few generations back where religious tolerance wasn't really an idea. Most people did not tolerate other religions, especially if you're a different race. Women were not tolerated in terms of having rights in the government, rights to own property. There's a few cases they did. So this idea, especially after the civil rights movement, is something that is fantastic, but it really started right here in Pennsylvania.
That is remarkable. Okay, so this is where Penn or one of his descendants would have sat as the royal governor.
And I should mention, after Pennsylvania separates from Great Britain in 1776, you know, all the colonies or the then states draft new constitutions. Later on in the 1780s, in fact, at the time of the Constitutional Convention, it is Benjamin Franklin who would have worked out of this office.
That's because he was the president of the state, right?
He was the president of the Executive Council. Essentially, his duties were that of governor. So right. I always, for most people that don't know all the details, I call him governor for sure.
Right, and that was under the Pennsylvania Constitution, which he helped draft.
It was.
And so there was this the Executive Council. He was the top guy. So this one is, in a sense, this was Ben Franklin's official office.
It was.
For heaven's sake.
So while he's downstairs, I can imagine in his breaks, he would have been carried up here to sign documents, worked out of his house a lot, which was only a block and a half down the street.
Well, I know he was old and in bad health then, so it was kind of a nice thing that everything was so convenient for him.
Yeah, he died just 3 years later.
Yeah.
I think if he was born a little bit younger, like he wishes in his writings, he would have seen a lot more of his influences on the country and in science, but especially in politics. I'd like to think Franklin would have been the only one that could have challenged George Washington.
Yeah.
Maybe not for his first term, certainly for his second, and if not, he probably would have beat out President John Adams.
Yeah, I think so. In fact, I've often heard it said that Ben Franklin was the founder with which one would most like to have a beer. and since that seems to be a requirement for our presidents, that they be likable, I think that Franklin would have stood very high in that regard.
Well, Franklin, there's a lot of myths about Franklin. There's some truths that people know about Franklin. He most enjoyed Madeira wine, though.
Right.
Rather than a beer. You know, that old saying is that beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy. He actually said wine.
Oh, really? So give me the Franklin quote again.
Wine is, I can't quote him exactly, but he essentially says, wine is evidence that God loves us and wants us to enjoy our lives, something like that, the exact quote.
A very wise man.
Yeah.
A very wise man indeed. Okay, and we're right here in his office. Very exciting. Okay, we're going where I suspect people never get to go on the tour. We're in a little side chamber right off of the stairwell. What are you going to show us, Adam?
I just wanted to show you some of the original fabric to the building. Most people think, oh, this is a reconstruction. It's not a reconstruction. 90% of the brickwork, the exterior, is original, and this is how I prove it to them. I show them this schist stone, which is actually behind the bricks.
No, you're going to have to spell that now, so people don't
schist.
Think...
S-C-H-I-S-T, schist.
All right, we're on a family show here, so we've got to be careful of our language. All right, schist stone.
And it was quarried outside of Philadelphia in a place called Conshohocken.
Right.
And believe it or not, in college, I lived right next to their old rock quarry. I never knew it. But you kind of see how thick the wall is. It's with the brick and everything, it's probably well over a foot before we get outside in thickness.
Well, that doesn't look like brick. If it is, it's very rough brick.
No, this is the schist, and then the brick is on the other side.
I see. So you got this very thick stone wall, mm-hmm. and then so the brick is just the facing of it.
And if you look up, you can see some of the original timbers.
Oh, yes, you certainly can. You certainly can.
And it's all been reinforced as well. You can see some of the steel reinforcements.
Right.
And that's mostly just to take the weight off some of the original timbers. They could probably still hold the weight of the building. But deterioration, especially with the traffic.
Oh, yeah, just thousands and thousands
shaking,
of people. Yeah,
yeah. You can imagine that it does contribute to deteriorating the original fabric to the building. But the interior, the woodwork is much less. It's about 70 to 75% of the original wood. So that banister that we just came down the stairs is the original banister. That is the banister Franklin probably touched. And
wow,
everybody
exciting.
Else in history coming up and down those steps.
Very exciting. Has President Obama been here yet?
Not as president. President-elect, he's been here twice.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Okay, great.
But not yet as president.
Okay. Well, we'll wait and see on that one. All right, we're walking into the West Wing of Independence Hall. And other people are here. You can hear them in the background. And now Adam is going to fill me in on what the significance of this is.
Now, on display here in the West Wing of Independence Hall are three original documents in our collection. Articles of Confederation, and the other is George Washington's copy of the Constitution.
Well, now I was recently at the National Archives, and they claim they've got the originals, but this is what they really are.
It all depends on what you mean by the term original. Your shoes are original.
Uh-huh.
But exactly what does that term mean? We have the original broadside. Basically, July 4, 1776, they did not sign the Declaration. It was actually August 2nd when that parchment copy was signed.
Right.
So they have the original parchment copy. We have the original July 4th edition that was printed, not signed. So you won't see any signatures.
Okay.
But it was released to the public the next day and over the next couple days. But they ordered it printed at July 4th that evening into the early morning of the 5th. We have one of only 25 surviving July 4th.
Okay, edition. That's very important in the sense then yours predates the signed copy that we're
it
all
does.
Familiar with because, of course, it took them time to get together and I'll come in and sign it.
Sure, and you can imagine when you're writing with a feather, it took some time to hire that guy.
I believe it. Now, here's very important. Now, the copy that you're talking about was one of those that were printed and then were taken right outside in the square here. And other places,
in
and
fact,
read out loud, right?
In fact, the copy that we have in our collection is the one used for the very first public reading here on the square, July 8th.
Well, then I think that you might even win the battle. This might very well be the original Declaration.
It very well could be. You know, it's one of a lot. We don't know how many were actually printed in 1776. And there were other printings that take place later. But John Dunlap is the guy that was hired, the printer that was hired by the Continental Congress to print it. We don't know what he printed it from. It could have been that rough copy that was given to him that was handwritten. We're not really sure.
Now, some people may be curious that it was not Ben Franklin who printed it, but he hadn't been in the printing business for many decades.
Franklin retired at the age of 42 in the year 1748.
And by this time, he was in his 80s.
So.
He's about 76 at the time.
Okay, he was a former printer at this time.
Former printer, okay. Although he still had active partnerships in printing.
Right.
And he always carried around a small press so he could release pamphlets, especially when he's in England and France.
Okay.
Active printing. Now he had retired long before.
So Dunlap got this job.
Yeah, and John Dunlap does have a connection to Benjamin Franklin. And follow me for a minute. John Dunlap is married to Benjamin Franklin's wife's niece.
His wife's niece, okay. Yeah, so related by marriage.
Related by marriage.
Kind of wonder if Franklin got a piece of the printing business.
Who knows? Who knows?
He always took care of his financial interests.
Well, by 1778, John Dunlap became the official printer for Congress.
Right.
So he also printed our copy of the Articles of Confederation and our copy of the Constitution.
Very, very cool. I was not aware that those were here.
One of the unique parts of our copy of the Constitution. One, it's only one of seven surviving prints from the Constitutional Convention in specifically September 17, 1787. One of the others out there is George Mason's, and Mason actually wrote his objections to it, and I believe that's up in Williams College in Massachusetts.
Oh, really? Okay.
But Washington's reading through it, and he noticed there's a typo, and he crossed it out and writes in the correction. They had to be reprinted after that.
So we have the one with the typo.
We have the one with the typo. There would be seven with typos.
Right.
And then the later printing would have the correction in it. And it just dealt with the clause in the Constitution that says Congress can take no action on the slave trade until 1808. That's what it was supposed to say.
That was the 20-year
20-year.
Yeah.
But it was actually printed 1708. So Washington notices the seven, crosses it out, and writes in eight over top.
Very interesting. I wonder if he hadn't corrected that typo, if that clause would never have taken effect then.
Lawyer question. Yeah, lawyer question. Not for me.
All right.
Let's take a closer look at it.
Yeah, let's.
So here's the Declaration on the left.
Right, and they're under very dim light in a case that I imagine is specially designed.
It is.
Does it have a special gas in there to preserve
them? Argon.
Argon, right? Argon.
Same thing that you find in your windows. It's
right.
A great preservative for documents.
Right. And these are remarkably well preserved. When I was at the National Gallery just a few weeks ago, I shared the disappointment everybody does when they look at the original copy of the Declaration, especially. It's very, very faded because, of course, it was displayed in bright sunlight for many years. Even the Constitution is somewhat faded, but these are all beautifully preserved and very legible.
They are, and that's mostly because they're print rather than the handwritten or the engrossed copies. Because if you look at the materials, one, this is rag paper.
Mm-hmm.
Our money is rag paper.
Right, so high-quality stuff.
High-quality stuff. It's made of cotton.
Right.
It goes through the wash. It doesn't deteriorate.
No acid, too, I bet.
Right, and you know, cash, it doesn't leak. It doesn't run.
Right.
It's really dying fabric.
Right.
So when they print it, and their ink, printer's ink, was linseed oil,
mm-hmm.
tree sap to make it sticky, and lamp black, which is soot.
Right.
So you're permanently staining this fabric. It's less susceptible than iron gall ink.
Wait a minute, you're telling me that the Constitution, the Articles, and the Declaration here are stains?
Essentially. Any printed document from the 18th century would be...
Okay.
A stained piece of fabric.
I understand. And I see you have a colleague here. I'm recording here for a radio show. If you don't mind, we want to add anything to it, want to come over and tell us. I'm looking at your name tag. You are Tony Collins.
Tony Collins.
Another Ranger. Anything you want to add to what Adam said about these things?
About these documents?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to watch people's reactions to them because
mm-hmm.
most people... This is not what they learned at school. It's not what they grew up with. It's not what they expect.
Right.
So
they expect the handwritten copies, don't they?
Right.
Yeah.
So they look at them and they say, where's the real one?
These are just Xeroxes.
These are just the Xeroxes,
so
right?
So then it's, you know, that's certainly an opening. You know, you could just say, well, these are real.
Those are very, very important
yeah.
ones. Well, thank you very much for sharing that with
us.
I appreciate it. And there's my card,
so you can
know where that's going to be. Okay.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you very mm-hmm. much.
You know, everybody
Thanks
just...
for visiting.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Everybody just glances over the Articles of Confederation. But really, it's a very important document. In fact, I think it's one of the most significant documents of the late 18th century.
Well, I can tell you why they glance over. It's because they haven't heard of it.
Yeah, people don't remember what didn't work.
Most
Americans
have no idea what the Articles of Confederation were. So why don't you enlighten us?
Sure. The Articles of Confederation, or what I like to call the first government, of the United States was only officially in place just for a few years. 1781 is when it's ratified by the 13th state. There, remember, as I said earlier, all the states were required to approve of it for it to go into effect until 1789 when the Constitution goes into effect. So it's really just a short 8-year time period that the United States would be governed by this document. It's a unicameral Congress. It's not a bicameral Congress like we have in the Constitution. So it's one house. They're appointed by their state assemblies or legislatures. They're not elected by the people. There's no executive, so there's no enforcement of law. That's really what our executive is charged with in the Constitution. And there's no judiciary at the national level. The states really were the ultimate sovereignty. So if you think about it, under the Articles of Confederation, it's a treaty amongst 13 sovereign nations. They very rarely had enough members show up that they could actually pass laws or enact anything.
Yeah.
And even so, you have no executive branch to enforce it. They really only had the power to coin money,
mm-hmm.
but I should also mention the 13 states also had the same power to coin money, so 14 currencies.
Right. That would make for a bit of a problem for the economy.
Very much so. Plus, you still want to add in the debt at the time. You also want to add in... you still see a lot of the Spanish currency here. A lot of the English currency was still here. Continental currency, you know, it's not worth a continental. A wagon load full of continental dollars could barely buy you a bucket full of supplies.
Right.
So inflation is a problem at the time. They could only really regulate, as they say, Indian peoples. They could create a postal service and coin money. And they could make peace and declare war. That's it. That's where they can act. So they lack very significant power that we would see in the Constitution, regulation of interstate commerce, the power to tax. Sounds great, right? No taxes. Awesome. But how's the government going to serve how's the government going to serve the people?
Unless you can tax. Exactly. In fact, that was one of the biggest weaknesses of the Confederation government. Yeah, and in fact, you know, whenever this has a lot of modern implications because, of course, there are many people now who say that they're advocates of states' rights. Well, we had a period of time when states' rights were supreme. It didn't work. I mean, we really were more 13 independent nations that had just loosely agreed to a treaty than we were one unified nation. So, you know, states' rights, it's an important part of our current constitutional structure, but if you take it too far, well, we've seen where that leads.
Right, and our Constitution, I should say, our Constitution of 1787, is a very delicate balance. And, of course, the Constitution as it was written next door had a few differences that we've changed through amendments. Remember, today we elect the senators. Back
right.
then, they were appointed. So there was that balance between the people, the House of Representatives, which were directly elected, the states, who elected the senators and the representatives of the states, and then the balance with the Electoral College, the people in the states... vote for an elector. The state decides who the electors are, and the electors will vote for the president.
Well, again, modern relevance. I believe you're talking about the 17th Amendment, and there are those today who want to repeal that.
Yes.
And they want to return more power to the states.
Yes. Yes.
I guess we'll always be debating the relative power of the states versus the federal government's
power. And I think that's the greatness of our Constitution. That's the greatness that the framers certainly wanted. That debate... the dialogue and the opportunity to change it if we think we can come up with something better.
Right. Very interesting.
Right behind us is actually the inkwell used for signing both the Declaration of Independence. That parchment copy you saw down in the National Archives and the Constitution.
They used the same inkwell. Someone thought to save it. Very good.
Yeah. We call it the Singh inkstand, named after the maker, Philip Singh Jr. He was a silversmith. Also, I should say, he was a very close friend of Benjamin Franklin. He cast this 1 year before the Liberty Bell. So in 1752, this inkstand was made for the Pennsylvania Assembly. We know it's there in August. I'm saying August because, remember, the parchment copy was signed August 2nd, 1776.
Right.
And then we know it was there... September 17, 1787. It's a very fancy inkstand. It cost about 25 pounds back then, which is about
$5,000. $5,000, wow.
It's hard to do the conversion between colonial British currency and our American dollar today.
But in current dollars, that's a $5,000 inkstand.
About that.
Well,
just
in
material.
Yeah, just in material, exactly. Of course, now it's priceless, and it's ornate, and it's beautiful, and you all keep it very well polished. I see there's no tarnish on it.
Yeah, we used to keep it out on the table, and then we had to put it in a safe every night. It was tarnishing it. We had to keep polishing it, and it's wearing very thin. So we put a replica over there and put the original on display here so it could be preserved.
Is that also in argon or some other
gas? It is. I believe it's in argon.
Yeah. Well, it's very well done, very pretty.
And we've got to stop. Isn't it terrible? I don't want to stop because there's more to come. Adam Duncan and I, Ranger Adam Duncan of the National Park Service, we didn't just see Independence Hall. We went next door and we saw Congress Hall and we saw where the Supreme Court met. We even walked down the street and we saw the Second Bank of the United States. It was great. We'll bring Adam back later. We'll have another episode. We'll talk more about Philadelphia. But for now, my name is Stuart Harris. You've been listening to your weekly Constitutional. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.